Welcome to the SASMA podcast, your source for the latest insights in sports medicine. Designed for healthcare professionals, we cover everything from injury prevention to athlete performance and mental health, helping you stay informed and excel in your field. Let's dive in.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the SASMA podcast. Today, I am joined by an incredibly accomplished clinician, sports scientist, researcher, who's going to have a chat about all things high performance and his journey throughout his career to date. So join me in welcoming Dr. Wayne Lombard. Wayne, great to have you.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here and it's going to be good to have a chat.
Wayne, let's start at the beginning and give everybody an overview. What is your journey into sports medicine? What has it been like?
Yes, it's been quite a long journey, Nick. So it started back in 2004 when I started my undergraduate degree in sports science at UKZ. The interest in biokinetics, science, exercise science came from playing cricket. I did play a bit of cricket when I was younger and played a couple of first-class games, just a handful, and then injuries happened and also decided to go the studying route rather than the professional sports route. So yeah, so started my undergraduate at UKZN, then eventually branched out into minors in biokinetics again at UKZN. Then moved over to Cape Town to Sports Science Institute, where I did my internship with under Justin Durant at the High Performance Center and the guidance of a lot of really high quality sports medicine practitioners, physiotherapists, biokineticists, etc. And obviously a lot of research that goes on at then Essen, and was mentored from a research perspective by Professor Mike Lambert, which I was very lucky to be mentored by. Then, yeah. Couple of years, about 5.5 years, 6 years at Sports Science. And while I was there, I did my master's degree, also M4 in biokinetics. And then Mike convinced me to enroll in a PhD. So yeah, long story short, spent 5.5 or 6 years at Sports Science, then left for China and worked in China for just over a year. Came back to South Africa, then went to India. Went to a new institute called Inspire Institute of Sport, where I was head of S&C for a period of time before being asked if I was willing to come over to the Indian national women's hockey team, and then did an Olympic campaign with them until Tokyo. After that, I decided to resign from that position, came back home, because it was quite a long campaign considering COVID was thrown in the middle there. Came back to South Africa and then started in the IPL. Spent a couple of seasons in the IPL, spent a couple of seasons in the South African SA20 League, and obviously running my own business, APA Training Systems, or Athlete Performance Authority, with Robin Ockhout. And yeah, so then from there, after the IPL, I have been involved in an academy called Lakshan Academy of Sports, also in India, in Bangalore, where I'm head of athletic performance there, just helping set up systems and process from a performance perspective. Recently joined the Hockey India League. So Hockey India League restarted this year. So I stepped away from the SA20 League to join the Hockey League. During the build-up to Paris Olympics, was with the South African women's hockey team, as well as a couple of individual Indian athletes. Some qualified, some didn't qualify. And yeah, so that's the long and the short of it. But it's been an exciting and interesting journey to now.
Wayne, you've had, or you have, an incredibly accomplished career. And I think what you've achieved at your young age, you know, most of us would be super happy with that if that was our whole career's life work. So well done on that. But there's so much to unpack. We're probably going to need a part two, but let's dive into some of those threads that you mentioned. If I can just bring you to some of those Olympic cycles that you spoke about, and I'm a big one for talking about different types of campaigns. I think if you take a season as the truest format of being a sports clinician working with the team for a whole season, I think a Olympic cycle is an even bigger scaled version of that. So can you take us through what are some of your considerations and what have you learned from preparing for not only team sports, but also individual athletes for really long macro 4-year Olympic cycles?
Yeah, it's a good question. Quite a tough one to condense into a few minutes, but I think I'll break it down into two aspects. One aspect would be obviously the periodization side, the sports science side, injury, risk mitigation side of things. And the other side would be the more what I'd call the fluffy side, where we also understand that performance is maybe more than just medals. But starting on the first aspect of it, depending on who you're working with, so for example, in hockey, or in team sports, it's very different to that, what you would be working with individual athletes. So a team sport like hockey is very competition-based, and you're dealing with a lot of congested match schedule and periods within a year. And there are very well predefined periods in the Olympic cycle where you have to achieve certain benchmarks to either qualify one for the Olympics. And if we take India, for example, you've got a couple of qualifications that need to happen. So you have to qualify for the World Cup for one, and there'll be certain events and competition that you have to achieve certain benchmarks to qualify for the World Cup. After the World Cup, if you have qualified for the World Cup, you're more than likely would have qualified for Asian Games, and then Asian Games becomes the main qualification period for the Olympic Games. If you don't qualify or don't win the Asian Games, then you got to re-look at everything and find where are the next qualification periods to be able to qualify for the Olympics. So for India, that was the case. We came second in the Asian Games. We lost to Japan in the final. And then had to re-look at the whole process to see, okay, is FIH going to be putting in the qualification periods, and how do we actually go about changing what we had initially planned and to try and qualify for the Olympics? And then to throw into the mix, that we obviously had COVID, we delayed the Olympics once we had qualified. So the team sport perspective is, one, you need to know where the qualification periods are, and I guess that's for individual sports as well. But you also have to take into account each individual athlete within that team sport and how they are coping along this path or journey that you're taking as a team. And that's where it becomes a lot more complicated in the team sport environment. With individual athletes, the individual athletes that I worked with, for example, with badminton, wrestling, and track and field, and each one has different qualifications. But I'm going to use wrestling as an example. Why I want to use wrestling as an example is because you can qualify the Olympics in a weight class, but not actually go. And because what happens is you'll secure a quota for your country at the qualification period. But then if you don't do well at the trials, the person who wins the trials will be the one that goes in that weight class. So you have to plan your training, your periodization, your strategies really carefully to ensure that not only one, the country gets the quota for that weight class, but two, that you are in a good enough shape to be able to win at the trials for that weight class to ensure that you actually go to the Olympics with that quota. So it becomes a little bit more complicated with individual athletes, because it's not always the fact that you qualify, you go. It's more about securing a quota and then making sure that you are the best at the right time within your country to be able to go to the Olympics for that sport. And then if we think of it from the other perspective and not from a sports science perspective, and I said it earlier, performance is more than just medals. I think if we don't embrace that whole journey and the process leading to the qualification, leading to whichever world event it might be, whether it's Olympics, whether it's World Cups, whether it's Asian Games, whether it's African Games, whatever it might be that you are preparing for, I think if we aren't embracing and enjoying the process going towards those events, it's going to be very, very tough. If you think about the Olympics, for example, I think it's 0.1% of the athletes that actually walk away with the medal. It is inevitable. I mean, how we deal with those failures is really important along the way. Keeping your inner circle really close and making sure that you've got a support group around you, not only from an athlete's perspective, but from a practitioner and clinicians' perspective as well, because a lot of times we think the pressure is just on the athletes, but from a practitioner, coach, S&C, physiotherapist, doctor, whoever it might be, you feel a lot of that pressure when you're working with these athletes, because you spend every day of the year, 24 hours a day, for a four-year campaign with these athletes, and you live that pressure with them. So understanding and how to deal with that pressure, not only from your own perspective, and how to deal with the pressure that the athletes are feeling is really, really important. And having that inner circle that can support you and understanding that the process is just as important as the medal, it's going to help you cope with the pressures. And if you go and your expectation is just to medal and you're not enjoying the process, not understanding the process, it can be a long, very depressing journey if you look at it as only an outcome-based process.
And I think you've done a really great job of summarizing a lot of the technical components as well as the more, I want to say, maybe psychosocial components as well. So thank you for that. I want to just touch on something that you mentioned and go to, I know you took a bit of time off after the Paris Olympics, I believe. And I think in both your Olympic cycles, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but you got incredibly close to medaling with multiple athletes or even with the teams. I want to just touch on that and say, how do you kind of manage the disappointment as a professional supporting athletes? Obviously, you feel a lot of their frustrations and disappointment, but how do you kind of process that on an individual or maybe personal level?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'll speak about Tokyo first. So Tokyo, with the Indian team, it was their best performance they've ever had in any Olympics that they had gone to, ending fourth, and we lost the bronze medal match to GB. So from that perspective, yes, we were very disappointed. We were actually leading that game, and we feel we should have won it, but if we actually introspect and really look at where we ended up, we probably overperformed for our ability at that point in time. So that one was a little bit easier to digest and understand. Okay, look, they've done really well. Sure, we should have probably won the bronze medal match, but in the greater schemes of things, if we had said, listen, we're going to play in the bronze medal match before we had quite arrived in Tokyo, we would have taken it. So that one's a little bit easier to process. Yes, it was disappointing to lose it, but from a greater perspective of where Indian hockey was and at that point in time, it was a really good achievement for the players and the team. If we fast forward to Paris, Paris is a completely different story and still not easy to talk about, but it is one that it is important to talk about and how to process these things. So with the Cyprus Women's Hockey team, sure, we went there, we didn't win a game, but the performance was pretty good. It's strange saying that when you don't win a game. Their performance for where they were at was also pretty good, but it was also extremely disappointing because there were certain games that we earmarked that we thought we should have won. So it was not easy to deal with. And at the same time, I had two athletes that I was working with at the same time in Paris that were also that gone into the Olympics with high hopes of medaling. So one was a badminton player called PV Sindhu, and she's one of the better or best badminton female badminton players in the world. And unfortunately, she lost to the current number one ranked player in a second or third game, I can't remember exactly, and was knocked out of the Olympics. So that was a really difficult one to deal with. But in the end, these things can happen when you draw the number one ranked player at that time. So although it was difficult to deal with or process, she dealt with it really well, processed well, and we knew where the lack of possible preparation or where we could have done better. Then looking at the wrestling side of things, I'm sure some of those listening might have heard about the story. Dinesh Bogart, she was competing in the freestyle wrestling, 50 kilo wrestling for women. And she drew world number one, who was a Japanese girl, and hadn't lost a point in 80 games. So our plan, or the plan of the coach, was that, look, we kind of know that she's probably going to lose that game or that bout, just because of where that Japanese wrestler was at that point in time in her career and how well she was wrestling. And that changed our plan completely from either going losing the game and then going into repercharge, or winning and then having to continue winning throughout the day, because once you win one bout, you don't actually get another opportunity to go into repercharge. So she had to keep winning. And the weigh in that morning obviously went fine. Then she had another bout about 30, 45 minutes later and won that one. And then she had one more, basically become the semifinal next one, which she also won, and then had qualified for the final. So as you're competing throughout the day, obviously you have to fuel and have to get some energy in, because weight cutting is quite tough for some athletes, and 50 kilos wasn't actually her natural weight class. But because of a whole lot of other political reasons, she chose to go up 50 kilos. And building up to that, she had a few injuries. She had an ACL before that, so that we had to reduce weight to ensure that she could compete. But long story short is that she weighed in on day two, 100 grams over, and was completely disqualified from the Olympic Games. So from having a guaranteed at least a silver medal, we thought she would probably have won the gold medal. And because of how she was wrestling that time, to being completely disqualified, and every single result that she had achieved on the day before was completely wiped off from the history of the Olympic Games. So it just, again, shows the margin for error, the margin for failure is so small at a world event like that. And then trying to process, okay, where could we have changed things? Where could we have done things differently for those 100 grand? It became pretty tough. And I think after that, with regards to how it went with the badminton player, how it went with the cycling world title team, and obviously with the disappointment on Dinesh weighing 100 grams over, and it was quite a difficult period those first few days. I think my phone was going nonstop from the media and the press in India. I just turned it off, and after that, went on holiday to Spain and took about two months off after that just to recalibrate and see where my next journey would take me.
Wayne, I think it's so fascinating to hear those stories. And this is from someone who's worked with you and followed you closely. And to hear some of the behind the scenes, absolutely incredible. Maybe it's a different time and place, or maybe at the next SASMA conference, but I think it would be great to hear some more of your stories in a Q&A format. But for the purpose of this pod episode, let me just move on quickly, Wayne, and onto my next point. I don't think it's as common as you kind of present it to be, but it's not very common for clinicians as actively involved in elite teams and attending such major world events and competitions to be as active as you are in research. I just want to unpack a little bit. Why do you think it's so important for someone who is as actively involved in the elite, sort of sphere of sports and sports medicine? Why is it important to you to also be contributing to academia, and maybe what can current postgrads kind of take or learn from you in this regard?
Yeah, I think, Nick, from my personal perspective, for me, the academia side of things was personally just to keep myself in touch with the latest trends on where science is going. But one of the things I've found with research is researchers tend to be guided by their own questions, not really by questions that are practically orientated and what can be used by the coaches or the people involved in sport. And I would like to try and take that route where we can see how can we change students' perspective on what research is important by getting coaches' input on what are the questions that they want answered. And people on the ground, practitioners that are actually working in teams, practitioners that are working with individual athletes, what are the questions that they want answered that are practically relevant to their to help performance. And I think at the moment what's happening in a lot of research is that we're trying to find projects or topics that can get done within 6 months instead of trying to find topics that are practically orientated to actually improve performance or actually help practitioners or coaches do their jobs better. And from my side, I think staying involved in what I enjoy lecturing, I enjoy sharing my experiences with up-and-coming practitioners, up-and-coming bios, physios, and sports medicine practitioners. But I think if you're not keeping up to date and you're not actively involved in research, you can get a little bit lazy and not actually do the background reading that you should be doing. And even myself, I don't think I do enough of the reading that I should be doing and not keeping up to date with certain areas of research. But unfortunately, when you are doing research, you have to kind of focus on certain niches at a certain point in time. But I think young practitioners coming through need to understand the importance of research, because science will always be behind what coaches are doing and what coaches are thinking, just because that's the way the system works. And if we can try and find a way to bridge that gap through practitioners doing research at the same time as working, it changes the game completely. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to stay in touch with the research and academia side of things, to ensure that somehow we can try and come up with better topics. Better is probably not a great word. Topics that are relevant to those working in the field and not just doing research.
I think that should be a quotable, that the research is always behind or lagging what's happening in coaching or in real time in sports. I think we are always playing catch up, and maybe that's why it's important to be kind of liquid thinking and to be adaptable. And I think personally, maybe that's where being involved in research or doing postgraduate work or, upskilling yourself around the science is so important, because it gives you that fluidity where you are evolving and you're constantly getting new information, and you may be constantly forcing yourself to reinvent yourself as a professional as well. So some great points that you've highlighted there, Wayne. Sorry, carry on.
That's exactly that. I spent a little bit of time in Kansas State University with one of my high jumpers from India. And the amount of it, I just learned just observing what track and field athletes do what track and field coaches are thinking, and just chatting to each coach. And just, I think what we also lack as practitioners sometimes is learning from our athletes, because we sometimes you get lucky and you get an athlete that thinks completely differently and really understands this sport so well and how they adapt to different circumstances. We can ask these questions from our athletes. We start learning exactly where research needs to point us in how we can improve performance in different codes of sports, and if we just listen to the coaches. So putting yourself as a young practitioner, putting yourself out there just to observe what coaches were doing and what questions they got in their mind that they don't have solid answers for from a scientific perspective, but have seen it anecdotally, is where I think we need to go and learn what good questions we can ask and try and find answers for.
Wayne, I'm going to pick on something that you said there, and it kind of alludes to a point that I think about a lot. Obviously, I've worked in different fields of sport, and I think you've worked in so many, and I think a lot of us tend to, we go from one sport to the next. But I want to just get from you, how important do you think it is to almost immerse yourself as a clinician or a professional supporting an athlete? How important is it to immerse yourself in all the technicalities of a sport? Even if you take track and field as an example, if you compare, I know you worked with a javelin thrower compared to maybe a sprinter, for example, the technicalities of that sport, although they both fall under track and field, is so diverse. And then you take hockey and cricket and all these other sports as well. How important is it for you to really try and develop some sort of understanding around either the technicalities of the sport or even just, the rules, and why do you think this is important for clinicians?
It's a good question. And one of my frustrations in the field is this: when people are looking for or applying for jobs, and there's like, okay, you need experience in hockey, you need experience in soccer, you need experience in rugby or whatever to apply for the job. There's always strength in diversity. And I think from my perspective, if you can become the best generalist possible, you start understanding biomechanics a little bit better, and you can start applying certain things that you learn from different sports in other sports. In saying that, yes, for sure, you do need to understand the technicalities. You don't need to be a coach, but you do need to understand the technicalities and understand what the coach is talking about when they are speaking about a hip lock or whatever it might be in the javelin throw or whatever the certain aspects that they are trying to improve on, or penultimate steps in a high jump. It is important to understand that, understand the forces that are maybe being transferred from the penultimate step to the jump, whatever it might be. But I do think that if you are keeping up to date with what space sport science is going, you understand general biomechanics, you understand physiology, you can start applying the general concepts to every single sport. But you do need to, for sure, go and update yourself on, if you are working with a javelin throw, for example, what are the specific key performance indicators for javelin throwing? What are the angles that they need to be releasing at? What fitness criteria for hockey players to be able to compete at international level? Cricketers, what sort of loads are fast bowlers experiencing during a T20 game versus a 50-over versus test matches, and et cetera, et cetera. So I do think once you know what sport you're involved with, you do have to have a better understanding of the dynamics of that sport. But being the best generalist possible is what I feel is one of my strengths, and being able to apply concepts from different sports to other sports is advantageous.
I think some great points there, Wayne. Maybe in terms of your generalist, I think you're being a little bit humble there. I think maybe another way of saying that is having a very solid foundation of the basics of, from anatomy, physiology, pathology, biomechanics, some of the sports medicine components. Yeah, having an incredible foundation and being able to draw on that as you move fluidly through different sports, and then kind of add the technical pieces on top. So yeah, I think that's a great way to summarize there. Wayne, for sports science students or sports medicine students that are listening and aspire to work in elite sports, sort of as you are now, what can they do as undergraduates or postgraduates to kind of prepare themselves for these future opportunities?
Yeah, so I'm going to borrow a passage from a keynote talk I did actually in India just a couple of months ago. And there's a couple of points I made to young students or up-and-coming sports scientists that I think are important. One is never stop learning. I think the field of sports science is constantly evolving, and people need to stay curious, seek out mentorship, and be open to new ideas. I feel that when you're studying, you feel that your education stops after graduation, but unfortunately or fortunately, education never stops, and you're going to keep keep along the journey of upskilling yourself, no matter once you graduated and once you start working, you've got to keep learning. And the second one would be, I think what we forget is we need to develop our soft skills. And I learned that quite quickly in my career. I think learning how to communicate effectively is extremely important, and not only just to our athletes, but also to coaches, the medical staff, and the management. I think if you've got a really good relationship with the greater management team of the teams or the athletes that you're working with, it makes your life a lot easier. And you need to be able to explain complex concepts in very simple terms. And it's sometimes nice to sound smart using these big words, but athletes don't care about that. Athletes always want to know how much you care about them as human beings first. And it sounds cliche, but it's 100% important that athletes want to know that you actually care about them, because they wouldn't employ you if you didn't have the skills. But if you're a complete, not such a nice person, they're probably not going to want to work with you. And then just building those relationships. We all know that trust is the foundation of our performance. And you need to take time to understand your athletes and how they tick as individuals. And just understand that your athletes are more than just training programs, rehab programs, and they're actually human beings. And they have different things that motivate them and different challenges in their life. As I spoke about earlier, you need to embrace those setbacks. The failure is inevitable, and we know that we're not just going to go to every event and get medals, and it's going to be a challenging journey, but it can be an extremely rewarding one if we embrace those setbacks. And a very important one for me is find a mentor. I think if you can find yourself a mentor, and it changes your perspective a lot, and just need someone to bounce things off. There's a quote by Isaac Newton that says, "I see further by standing on the shoulders of giants." And I feel that my base was set at Sports Science Institute, being able to pop down to the ground floor and chat to the likes of like a Prof. Wayne Derman or Prof. Martin Schwalmers, have Justin Durant as my manager, having many senior buyers that I can bounce ideas off, top-class physios, just allowed me to change my perspective and learn so much about how not only to deal with athletes, but deal with people, learn from them, and just allow me to grow as a practitioner, especially in my early years of working. The other point would be understanding why you want to do this job. For me, my why was possibly to change the world for a few people, and I've used sports science as what I'd call my recipe book for doing that. And just being fearless in pursuit of what you want to do and want to make a difference in someone's life from something that they're passionate about. So when you're getting an athlete, you've got to understand that they are super passionate and they got some massive goals that they want to achieve, and you're just a small part of that journey. But you are actually quite an important part of that journey, because if you start understanding what they want as individuals and how they tick, you can play a massive role in their life. And something that I think you and I have spoken about a lot, Nick, is that whole Dunning-Kruger effect. I think as young graduates, you come out of college, varsity, thinking that you've learned everything possible, and come out quite arrogant, for lack of better words, thinking that, okay, I know everything about everything, but actually not knowing what you don't know becomes quite dangerous in the field of sports science and medicine. And just understanding, being humble in what you know, and also being able to accept or admit if you don't know something. But once you know that you don't know something, go out and find those answers. And the answers are always out there, and that's why finding a mentor is really important, because you need someone to bounce ideas off. But in today's world, there's so much information. You need to be able to sift what is correct and what's working for you as an individual in a certain environment that you're working in. And from that, that possibly won't work for you. So yeah, I think from a young practitioner, those would be my 7 points that I think that they doubt lean towards advising them.
Wayne, I think you've wrapped this whole conversation and episode up so beautifully at the end there that I'm not going to push or squeeze one more question. I just want to say, on behalf of the pod and SASMA, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you so much for sharing your insights. This definitely can't be the last time that you share some of your knowledge from a sports medicine and just from your professional journey with our broader community. So looking forward to more episodes with you, and hopefully getting you to speak at a congress maybe in the future. Yeah, I just want to say thanks for your time. I know you're a very busy guy. The conversation was really appreciated and incredibly insightful for me. I'm sure a lot of the listeners are going to enjoy it as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Nick. Really appreciate the time.